Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Wait What If podcast. Thanks for checking it out. I am back. We had some glitches over the last few weeks. Had a great episode. The last episode with Jason Sieb came in right before New Year's. I think it was like the 29th or 30th or something like that. Really good, really important episode, actually. We were supposed to talk about, he has this diet called the Alt-Shift diet, and it's very paleo ancestral type of thing, way outside the box as far as convention goes or conventional medicine. And then he brought up this whole thing about psychology, you know, and why so many people will succeed at a diet and then come off it. And he, being a successful athletic trainer, and he had a gym, and he had this diet book, and, you know, he had all these things that were pushing people towards success, and they were ultimately leading to failure. And he was like, what's going on here? So he wrote this other book called Body Beliefs. If you go to altshiftdiet.com and check out, I think if you just sign up for his newsletter, you get a copy of Body Beliefs. It's a PDF. And if you are really, if there's ever been a time in your life where you were, you know, trying to transform, I try not to tell my patients I want them to lose weight. I don't want them to lose weight. I want them to transform their body composition. I want them to reduce that body fat percentage. If there's ever been a time in your life where you've struggled with this or you've done this, then I suggest you read the book. It's going to give you not tips like, you know, exercise or diet or anything like that. It's going to allow you to check the emotional stuff that goes along with it. You know, when you do lose the weight, what happens next? You know, is it puppy dogs, ice cream, and rainbows, or are we going to fall off the track? So I don't know. He just hit a whole aspect that I never even considered. It was very, to me, it was very eye-opening episode. And I actually took away from it lots of things that I bring now to my patients. So it was a really cool episode. Guys, it's the new year. We are doing a lot of new things with Wait What If Podcast. In fact, if you go to the website, it's now Wait What If Productions, because last year we played a little bit with this Better Off Med, which we're still going. I say we, it's like me, and then Savannah comes on every now and then, but I do, and then John Taylor, but we'll get into that in a second. So whatever, working on Better Off Med, and Better Off Med's really just, I'm teaching myself the video aspect of it and just playing around with YouTube. There's a whole issue now with monetizing YouTube, and I don't care about any of that. I'm just trying to, with Better Off Med, I'm trying to approach medicine from a different angle and just having fun with it. So you can check out Better Off Med. There'll be more of that coming up. I have a bunch of pre-recorded episodes, but I'm busy. It's just me over here. So I'll get them up. The other thing we're working on, check it out, 318 Productions or 318 Productions. It is a co-production with John Taylor over at Twisted Podcast. So check out John Taylor's website, twistedpodcast.com. He also has truecrimewriting.com. Really, really interesting guy. But we're collaborating on a project. Nothing that's going to come out anytime soon. But it's an interesting project. We're doing a lot of filming, a lot of research, it's a really exciting project, and I'm really, really stoked to be part of it. So we're having fun with that. In order, now here's the part where I have to ask for a little help, and I'm not going to ask for Patreon. You don't have to pay me, no money. I'm not looking for money. But if you shop on Amazon, and I know everybody shops on Amazon, could you just do me the favor? Just quick little favor, do it right now. If you're going to buy something today, do this. Go to waitwhatif.com, click on my Amazon affiliate link right at the very top. It'll say, like, I think I wrote WWI Amazon affiliate link. Just click on that and then go about your purchasing. It won't cost you a penny extra, but I will get credit for driving you towards Amazon, and we can, I can start improving a lot of my gear, my tech gear, my video stuff, just basically everything that it takes to run a podcast takes some money. And I've been doing this out of pocket now for years. And if you just do that simple thing, go to waitwhatif.com, click on my Wait What If affiliate link. Whenever you're like, all right, I'm going to buy this, whatever. I've been saving up to buy this smoker. I just bought a smoker, by the way. You're going to go buy that smoker, say, I'm going to help Kevin out. And I'm going to click on the WWI affiliate link, and then you help out the show a little bit. I make like, 2 or 3%, pennies on the dollar, and you pay nothing extra, but it helps me out in the long run. And that's about it. I'm trying to think if I have anything else to bring up. I guess that's been a lot. Last week I had an episode out, or it was supposed to come out, but we had some scheduling issues with a guest, and I don't know what happened with the guest. He was interesting. I read his book. I was all ready to go, and I don't know, something fell through. So I'm going to try to get this guest on in the future, because I did a lot of prep for it, and I was hoping he'd be on. So tonight we're going back to conspiracy theories. So you can look back about, half dozen episodes ago, and I had this guy who came on. He was trying to convince me, the person who's obsessed with aeronautics and the moon landings, but I'm obsessed in a scientific way, not in a hoax way. I, as a kid, I always wanted to fly in the space shuttle. It's just everything. That's why I went into the Air Force, sort of. But he came on and he basically told me that they were a hoax and that telescopes aren't real, and just this list of completely ridiculous conspiracy theories, and I wasn't buying it. And I think the tone that I brought to the conversation was much like what I'm using right now to talk to you, just very conversational. This is what I think. And this guy went off his meds. I mean, he was screaming at me. I had to turn down his volume a little bit because it was getting ridiculous. We couldn't have a conversation. He didn't want to know my side of the story. He didn't want anything I told him. I was like, what about this or that, or how about refractory, or how about he didn't want to hear it, and he just wanted to scream at me. So let's back up a little bit. Tonight's guest is, I'm going to butcher his name because that's what I do, Joseph Usinski. I think that's it, Usinski. He's associate professor over at University of Miami. He received his bachelor's degree from Plymouth State University up in New Hampshire. I think that's the New Hampshire one. It's got to be, right? And that's when you went to high school in New Hampshire, if you're going to go in the state school system, you had like big three you could go to. You could go to Plymouth State, you could go to University of New Hampshire, and then you go to Keene State. But most people, and then there's a bunch of other little ones, but those are like the big ones that you went to. And it looks like he went to Plymouth State. In fact, the last time I was at Plymouth State University, I was, it must have been in the mid-90s, and I was contesting a minor in possession of alcohol citation. Yeah. But it was like, 20 years ago. 21 years, whatever. So he went to Plymouth State University. This guy's from New Hampshire, apparently. I'm going to have to ask him about that because he got his master's from the University of New Hampshire. My alma mater. He got his doctorate from the University of Arizona. His research has appeared in the Journal of Politics, Political Research Quarterly, and Critical Review, among other scholarly outlets. His first book, The People's News, Media, Politics, and Demands of Capitalism, New York University Press 2014, addresses how audience demands drive news content. His second book, American Conspiracy Theories, Oxford University Press, 2014, co-authored with Joseph Parent, examines why people believe in conspiracy theories. So he is going to bring to light, my whole nightmare of an episode dealing with this other fella about why the moon landings were a hoax. So I think this is going to be an awesome episode. I got a lot of questions for him. He seems like a nice guy. So without further ado, Joseph Usinski.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
I did an intro before we came on here, just basically off your Miami site there. Give me a little bit of, what got you into this area of conspiracy theories? I mean, specifically, you wrote a book about it. What drove you to that point?
So I did my PhD dissertation on the profit motives behind news.
Okay.
So, if you think about, why do journalists write what they write? Most people would say, well, it's the news. These are the important things that we need to know. Mm-hmm. And what my argument was that journalists through one means or another, would find out the things that people wanted to know about, mm-hmm. and then that's what they wrote about. So, I mean, if you think about the news, it's really not the most important things going on. It's really a set of purposeful decisions that are made by journalists and editors and producers, and just through a series of processes, those who, you know, those outlets that succeed and those journalists that succeed are the ones that draw viewers in.
Okay.
A lot of what we assume is that the media reports stuff and then it changes how we think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why we're so concerned about things like media bias, because if the media is biasing things and it changes what people think, it could change how they vote and, you know, have a undue impact on governance, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But if that doesn't happen, if all that's really going on is that the media just tells us what we want to hear anyway, then one, something else is driving our opinions to begin with, and two, the media doesn't really have an impact on what we think. So
right.
if you take this to a more vulgar place, like cable news, and then even to like the fake news stuff that we think about today, what it tells us is that, yes, there's money to be made by telling people what they already think.
Yeah, confirmation bias. It's almost like,
yes.
Yeah. You got people on social media now that will only subscribe to what they're thinking, and the amazing thing with social media versus, you know, a newspaper that you could read, you know, 20 years ago is that not only do you get, you can subscribe to a certain way of thinking, but you have those, you can interact with those people, and you're patting each other on the back for just regurgitating the same political ideologies or theories or whatever.
Yes. And it's taking place now, mm-hmm. but it was always taking place,
yeah.
right? I mean, we like to think of this golden age where everything was objective and journalists always did the right thing, but
right.
I mean, I'm from New Hampshire. My family read the Union Leader. We didn't read the Nashua Telegraph.
Okay.
I mean, there was a clear choice there.
Sure.
And it was driven by what we believed, which was different than what, you know, the liberal neighbors who got the Telegraph believed.
Yeah. My family was a Union Leader too.
Yeah. So this has always been going on. And actually, if you go back 100 years where there was a lot more choices in newspapers, you got even more differentiation.
Right.
But I mean, if you take this idea and put it into what they're saying about Trump now, like, oh, Russia threw the election for Trump by, you know, putting out this fake news. You know, the people who read it, you know, read it because it just told them what they already wanted to hear.
Right.
And the studies are showing that, yeah, conservatives consumed a ton of fake news, far more than liberals did
mm-hmm.
in the lead up to the 2016 election. But I mean, there's a easily understandable reason for that. I mean, conservatives could not get anything they wanted from the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other newspaper because none of them endorsed Trump. In fact, almost all of them hated Trump.
Yeah.
So if you were just a regular person, you know, and you just want to read things that are going to tell you what you want to hear and are going to be comforting reading,
mm-hmm.
you've got to go to the fake stuff. You don't have a choice.
Right.
You know, particularly consider all the polls were showing Trump was going to lose. And,
sure.
You know, so if you wanted to hear something positive, you had to go to the fake stuff.
So tell me if I'm getting this correctly, your theory, I guess, of journalism is that you have this collective groupthink and the journalism comes out of that versus you have a group of people that want information and they get it from the news. The news is almost like a microcosm of what everyone's thinking in general anyways. Is that correct? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
And if you go back, you know, let's say to AB, you know, back to the golden age of the, you know, when you had the big three, mm-hmm. you only had three channels, you know, they were shooting for something near the median consumer. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But now because you have so many different outlets and you have, you know, newspapers, internet outlets, you can have multiple cable channels, you have much more availability for choice now. Now you can have outlets that go after segments of the population.
Right.
So
right.
Fox News and MSNBC aren't going after the median news consumer. Mm-hmm. They're going after people who are, you know, out on the edges. Right.
Yeah. And I think back in those days, the median consumer was the majority, and that's where, like, my great-grandfather, who was he was from up in Buffalo. He was a grain operator, a grain elevator. He worked in one of those or something. Him and his whole, you know, my whole family on that side were liberals. We could call them like, but not liberals. They were Democrats. I'll say they were Democrats. And my father, or I'm sorry, my mother's whole side were Republican. But in those days, there wasn't much difference between the two. There was a lot of commonality. So I think I see why they were doing that. Whereas today, if you align yourself, say, with a Republican or with a Democrat, there's almost a chasm between the two ideologies. At least that's how I see it.
And that's probably true. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine there are people who have to vote one way or the other and probably do so for the same party regularly.
Right.
But I mean, a union member from Pennsylvania who votes Democrat is a lot different than the progressive in San Francisco.
Okay, yeah.
Who's sending checks to the DNC, right?
Right, right, yeah.
So those are two very different Democrats. Just like you have Republicans, you know, you might have Republicans who care about free markets, mm-hmm. or something like that. But they don't really care too much about the social conservative aspect of it.
Right, right.
And I mean, you go back to the 70s. I mean, Nixon was instituting price and wage controls. I mean, is there a big difference between the Republicans of the 60s, 70s and, you know, Democrats at that time or Democrats of today? Right. I don't know. I don't think it's that big of a difference. And then on the social conservative stuff, you didn't really have this big sorting, mm-hmm. until Ronald Reagan, I think, sort of pulled those social conservatives in to his camp. And you get the moral majority types getting leverage within the Republican Party,
right? And I guess if you take that social conservatism out of it, you would see a lot more in common between someone like Bill Clinton and George Bush, right? Junior, the second one there, where we like to think that there were major differences between the two.
So George W. Bush was compassionate conservatism.
Right, right. Okay, that's what it was, yeah.
And Bill Clinton said, hey, the era of big government is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like, I mean, you could look at, pre-9/11, mm-hmm. You could look at the George H.W. Bush, Clinton, and George W. Bush presidencies and say, you know, what was really different, mm-hmm. between those years? Not much.
Right.
I mean, it was a very similar thing, and so, but that's different now. I think the leaders in the parties are very polarized. There is some debate as to how much people are polarized, mm-hmm. on various issues, but I would say one thing that's sort of that we see a lot more of is negative partisanship. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much about me caring about my party. It's about me not liking the other side. So take some of those things and put them together. You've got profit-driven news that's segmented, and then you get people who really don't like the other side. So right. You wind up with news outlets that are demonizing the other side, and now you have sort of fertile ground for conspiracy theorizing.
Okay.
And that's sort of where it's at. I mean, I got on the topic – maybe 9 years ago, it was my co-author who sort of came to me and said, conspiracy theories, causes and consequences, let's, mm-hmm. do it.
Yeah.
And I looked around and I'm like, there's no data on this. Like, there hasn't been a lot of survey questions asked over time. It's not like anyone's collected data sets or done any analysis on this. So I said, we're just going to have to go in sort of blind. So we did, and it took a number of years to get the book out, but we were able to make a big mark on the field because I think we're the first ones to put out a book that was just all data driven rather than sort of, you know, relying on conjecture.
What kind of data were you collecting as far as conspiracy theories go?
So the easiest thing we did was to run a national survey where we asked people about, you know, their underlying, you know, conspiracy mentality and who they thought was conspiring against them. And if they believed in voter fraud. So we asked questions like that, and we were able to compare that to their demographics and their partisanship and their political ideology. And then the other thing we collected was about 100,000 letters to the editors of the New York Times, about 1,000 letters a year over the course of 120 years.
Wow.
So from 1890 to 2010, and we had our research assistants read them all. And we picked out all the ones that discussed the conspiracy theory. So out of that 120,000, it whittled down to about 800.
Okay.
And we were able to see clear patterns over time. And the big pattern was that whatever the party of the White House was, they were the ones who were being accused of conspiring.
Okay.
So when a Republican's in the White House, it's Republicans and big business who are being accused of conspiring, presumably by Democrats.
Okay.
When a Democrat's in the White House, presumably Republicans are the ones doing the accusing, and they're accusing Democrats, communists, and socialists of conspiring.
Sure. Yeah, you saw it all the time. I was going to say, you see it all the time.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
And they do it in equal amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find is that these things just sort of track power.
Okay.
And then we were able to sort of work backward from that and say, well, why is this? You know, what would be driving people out of power to accuse people in power? And given that the major variable was power, I mean, that's where we started.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we push is that conspiracy theories are for losers.
Okay.
And we don't mean that as a pejorative. We mean it as a descriptive.
Right.
And that is that people who are out of power are the ones who are going to use conspiracy theories. One, for psychological reasons, mm-hmm. is that they feel powerless, and that drives you to think people are out to get you. And on the other hand, there's a strategic logic there that if you are facing a powerful enemy, like if you're a Democrat right now, you don't have the White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives, or the court.
Right.
Like, you're completely out of power. So you have a terrifying enemy, you know, Trump and the Republicans, and you need to call out who that enemy is. You need to close ranks, and you need to motivate collective action. Now, we saw the same thing happen when Obama won in 2008. Like, he took the House, the Senate, and now the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So the Republicans, you know, thought he was a Muslim, thought he faked his birth certificate, and they were going nuts. And then death panels came up.
You're right.
And they parlayed that into collective action. They were able to do very well in the 2010 election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what the Democrats are going to do this time.
Is there a way – is it a way that they – okay, so they feel powerless and they have to work within the system. And if there's a conspiracy theory or if there's a conspiracy that's outside our law, then it gives them a semblance of hope. Maybe we can impeach this guy. Maybe there's something in the Constitution that can get rid of him. Is that why they go for it?
It solves wounds too, right? So imagine, you know, if you play sports and you lose – you know, you could be a good sportsman, or you'd say they cheated.
Right, right.
Right.
Tom Brady's footballs.
Yeah. So if you know, going into an election, both parties are equally convinced that the other side is going to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
After the election, that number cuts in half because only the losing party
that's right.
thinks that the other side cheated.
Right.
And both sides do it in just about equal number. So whoever loses thinks that they were cheated. That's what they do to make themselves feel better. How could our candidate have lost? It wasn't that the other side had a better candidate. It wasn't that they have better ideas. It wasn't that we screwed up. It was that they cheated. And that sort of puts everything in perspective. And that's exactly what's been going on here. So how do you explain a loss to this president that you despise if you're a Democrat?
Yeah.
So, well, he conspired with Russia.
Yeah. Psychologically, is this a healthy thing for societies to do? Or is it a natural thing? Did you guys?
It's natural.
Okay.
Healthy is another question. I don't know. It depends how far it goes. I mean, I would prefer that people's beliefs track as closely as possible to reality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily bad to have some people questioning results of elections or people who have an intense skepticism of the powerful, because, I mean, that pays benefits, right?
Right.
In a democracy, you can't just trust everything the powerful tell you. Embedded in the system is this idea that you have to have skepticism, mm-hmm. right? So there are benefits to it. So I would never advocate getting rid of conspiracy theories.
Okay.
But there are times where they can be very dangerous. And I think, that was the case with the healthcare bill. I mean, there are reasonable debates to have about Obama's healthcare bill. Mm-hmm. Death panels was probably not one of them.
Right.
There are reasonable debates to have about, Trump's tax bill, but fleecing the country for the millionaires is probably not one of them.
Right.
There are reasonable things to say about the election, but Russia hacked it is not mm-hmm. one of them. In the
21st century, with things like with social media, does it add a new dynamic to this? Is there something that, a conspiracy theory for an election lost, say, in 1970 versus a conspiracy theory in 2017? Or what do you see in the future, too, with this?
A lot of people overestimate the social media and its impact.
They overestimate or...
Yeah.
Okay.
Vastly overestimate. Okay. Because a lot of this is driven by what we already believe. Like if you're a Republican or a Democrat, most likely you were raised that way. And it just sort of solidified, mm-hmm. By the time you're 30. I mean, most people, how they vote when they're 30, they're going to vote that way when they're 90. And the world can burn in between and it doesn't really matter. It's just these things are so ingrained in us.
Okay.
Most people are what their parents are politically, and as much as we may fight it, I'm 42, I look in the mirror and I see my mother and I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
And there's not much I can do about it. And there's right. not much anyone can do about it. It's sort of subconscious stuff. It's heavily imprinted on us when we're young. Mm-hmm. I got out of the house early, so I've been able to sort of direct myself a little bit more mm-hmm. than I think a lot of other people do.
Yeah.
So where my mother's a hardcore social conservative, I'm a libertarian.
Right. Good for you.
but for most people, the story is they are what their parents are. And if they're not, they're at least a product of socializing influences.
Right.
And that stays with them. And that creates their worldview, which sort of colors how they interpret everything. So if you were to ask a Trump-Russia conspiracy theorist and say, what do you think about this Trump-Russia thing? Well, it absolutely happened. You say, well, what if I gave you evidence that either shows it didn't or suggests that your evidence isn't very compelling? You say, well, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm convinced it's true, they would say. And that's, people believe things because they think they're true, not because they think they're false. So mm-hmm. So these worldviews sort of drive all of this. So with partisanship being the biggest one, we like to think our team is the best and the other team sucks. And when we win, it was just. And when we don't, it was, we were cheated. And the things our party does are all great, and the things the other party does are terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's the funny thing. It's like you do polls on somebody like Ben Bernanke, which nobody cares about, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When Bush was president, Republicans liked him and Democrats hated him. And then when Obama became president, it flipped.
Right.
Yeah. It's not that the guy was doing anything different.
Right.
Just all of a sudden, because people assign responsibility, think that he's working for the president.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, each side decides, what's good and what's bad. Right after the election, Democrats started to think the country was going in the wrong direction, and Republicans started to think it was going in the right direction. But nothing changed.
Right, right. Especially not right after.
Yeah, except for who sat in one chair in one house, mm-hmm. right? Just the presidency. But no policy changes had happened at that point.
Right.
But somehow, the country was going to burn. That's pure viewpoint.
Yeah.
Right? So our viewpoints color reality so much. And it's you have to work really, really hard to get out of it.
That's interesting. That takes us full circle, because then it's those viewpoints that drive where you're going to seek out those viewpoints, which drives the news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a tough spot. I mean, I you know, in my profession, almost everybody is a liberal. Mm-hmm. You know, numbers I hear are like 9-1 liberal to conservative. That sort of underestimates the amount of liberalism in my discipline.
Oh, wow.
Where it's like, you know, you don't find a lot of communists out on the street, right? Mm-hmm. But in academia, you got a ton of them.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, when you say 9-1 liberal, you've got communists, neo-Marxists, European socialists.
Oh, yeah. I've heard more descriptive terms for political discourse these days than I what the, like, anarcho-communist, and it's like some... It's crazy. It's
got those too. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's funny how you're from New Hampshire. I'm from New Hampshire. We're the same age, and we have this libertarian backbone from the state that's live free or die. And I wonder how much of that. So I don't know if I wrote this in my email to you, but when I have this gun debate with people, and I have it all the time, I mean, you can't help it. People mention it and everything. And I try to explain to them that there is a group of us that. And it had to have been the way we were raised, or maybe even where we were raised geographically, where the idea of gun ownership really doesn't have anything to do with the gun itself, but has a lot to do with almost a genetic political yearning for self-reliance. And that's really what it comes down to me. And I know there are a lot of other people that think this way. It comes down to, I don't want someone in my house to tell me I can't have this. And that stems, if you think about it, you know, all the way back to the revolution. These were the fundamentals of the revolutionaries. It was about self-reliance.
I mean, go back to the 80s. I mean, the big ideas coming out of the Reagan revolution were, you know, sort of free market economics.
Right.
If he was able to, I mean, he lowered tax rates, you know, and my feeling on Reagan is he should have been able to go much, much further than he did. But, mm-hmm. but that was the big idea is, you know, free markets like capitalism do its thing. And that wasn't really a viable option prior to that. Mm-hmm. So that's the decade I grew up with, a very popular Republican president who wanted free, you know, economic and personal freedom and personal responsibility.
Right.
And that's what's imprinted on me.
Yeah.
In a state where the license plate says live free or die, you don't have to wear seatbelts. You don't have to wear, motorcycle helmets. There's no sales tax, no income tax. There's no social services.
Right.
And, you know, the big decisions in government are made at the school board meeting.
Right, right. That's right.
You know, with your neighbors. So that's something that's sort of stuck with me. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that my libertarian ideology is a choice. It very well may not be. And besides that, I fit the demographic profile. I mean, I'm a white male Gen Xer.
Yeah.
You know, who grew up during the Reagan Revolution, and I'm from New Hampshire.
That's true. And we didn't really, depending on what business you got into after college or whatever, we really didn't feel the brunt of an economic downturn till like 2008. I mean, there was that one at the end of the 90s, 99, 2000, but a lot of us were just getting into the workforce or we were still in our grad school years and it didn't really hit us. So, I mean, that's from 76 is when I was born till 2008 is 32 years of prosperity, really. We didn't see the hardship. And so whatever we grew up with seemed to be reinforced. We had no reason to turn on it.
And it was all the same thing, too. It wasn't like Clinton offered some very different thing.
No, not at all.
He offered the same thing, and George W. Bush, largely the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that was what was imprinted on me. And then when Obama took over, it was like left turn.
Yeah, it was completely new. Yeah.
you know, no pun intended, but it was completely foreign to me.
It was, yeah.
You know, what he wanted to, you know, the things he wanted to do. I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me. That's mm-hmm. not what I've grown up with. That's not what I see as working.
That was a big shift. I had to read, I ended up reading Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals just because I heard it mentioned during, and that's probably conspiracy. That probably falls into that area. But I remember hearing it mentioned during the election, and then how, I don't know if he brought it up or somebody brought it up. So then I had to read it because I heard it helped formulate his political ideologies, but or am I a victim? Or am I a victim of a conspiracy theory?
You know, here's the thing: I don't know what's true or not anymore.
Yeah,
it's, just it's very difficult to know. I mean, because a lot of things that get reported, then you find out, you know, right away. Oh, that was either wrong or reported very wrong.
Okay, yeah,
and it's happening on things of all sides. Now, did I hear that Alinsky helped Obama form his ideology 1,000 times?
Right.
How true is it, or how much of an impact? I just don't know.
Right. Clinton met with him. Did you know that? And again, I don't know. I could be going down the conspiracy alley, but when she was a child, oh, not a child, she was a young woman. I don't remember exactly when, but she was a protege of him. She actually had meetings with, yeah, it's pretty amazing. Oh. So I want to kind of change gears here because there's the political conspiracies. I would call them, it seems almost like a bread and butter conspiracy that some people don't even realize they're espousing within, you know, their everyday political thinking. And honestly, I never, until you just mentioned it now, I never considered that, you know, just that whole aspect of maybe me reading Saul Alinsky because I heard Obama is my way of kind of participating in that sort of thing. But the conspiracy theories that I think most people are familiar with, and where I actually got my, I'll call it baptism under fire, is when I invited a gentleman on. He didn't even want to go by his real name, and I think there was, he did, so I don't know if conspiracy, he thought someone was going to hunt him down or whatever, but he managed to go on a close to a 2-hour tirade about how the moon landings were fake. And I, having grown up during the space shuttle years, that's what I wanted to do since I could walk, crawl, talk. I wanted to be an astronaut. So my whole life, I would turn my camera around right now, but I even have a picture of Neil Armstrong from Life magazine heading out to the launch pad. So it was a big part of my life, and he just basically argued for 2 hours how it was complete baloney sausage. Can we talk about those people? Are you schooled in that area?
Yeah. So, okay. So there's another aspect too. And so with the political conspiracy theories, partisanship drives a lot of it. But the other dimension to this is a disposition towards seeing the world in conspiracy terms.
Right.
Like some people more than others think that conspiracies are likely. So on the bottom end of that scale, you got people when they hear a conspiracy, they're like, that's just not true. I don't believe that sort of stuff. And on the high end of that scale, you got people who think there's a conspiracy lurking behind every corner. Mm-hmm. And we have relatives that probably fit, you know, each of those molds. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
So you get together for Thanksgiving, you'll have an uncle who thinks JFK was killed by a conspiracy, the moon landing was faked, and this, that. Mm-hmm. Then you have another uncle who says that's all crap.
Right.
Right? So it's not so much about the evidence for any of those individual conspiracy theories, it's about the disposition they have towards that sort of logic. Mm-hmm. You know? So when you take the partisanship aspect out of it, you now have just this clear dimension where you have some people are more disposed to buy into it and some people are less disposed to buy into it.
Okay.
So, you know, a conspiracy theory like the moon landing is not that popular in the U.S. You know, most people don't buy it, and it's a pretty extreme theory.
Right.
So
it's a complicated theory, and that's where I throw it out, is because I mean, my grandfather worked on the I want to say the Apollo missions not even directly. He was in Lansing, Michigan, working. I can't remember the name of the plant, but they were working on a hatch, And, you know, he got a thank you letter from the president and all this stuff for his great work. And I mean, the conspiracy would have to go so deep that we're talking now probably in the hundreds of thousands of connections would all have to fall into place and no one could speak.
But see, what you're doing is sort of thinking through it.
Right.
And sort of finding reasons to find that it's not true. Mm-hmm. Right. Or if someone thinks, I think this might be true, then they find evidence that supports, you know, their already foregone conclusion, right?
Right.
So if I'm like, I think that moon landing's faked, I could just Google faked moon landing, find the evidence that supports what I already think, and now all of a sudden I have a bunch of evidence to back up what I think. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really driven by evidence in the first place. It was just driven by my disposition to think moon landings are faked.
Right. And you can go down that rabbit hole anywhere. I don't know if you've ever gone into YouTube just for fun and clicked on like Flat Earth and listen what they say. And they're very convincing. A lot of these 9/11 videos are very convincing. But and you can almost like a horror movie is convincing. You can put on a horror movie and say, oh my goodness, you know, you're being attacked by aliens or whatever. And kind of feel that for a little bit. But then when you leave the theater, you say, oh, well, that was entertaining. But it's just not, I'm not going there.
So here's the interesting thing. There's a reason why those videos might be so similar is that they're competing for an audience, right?
Right.
So they're going to move towards the median conspiracy theory consumer.
Okay.
Just like you get, you know, Britney Spears, Mandy Moore, Christina Aguilera, and Jessica Simpson are all singing the same tune.
Yeah, that's right.
They're going after the same thing. You know, right. Why is 98 Degrees and Backstreet Boys and NSYNC the same stuff? Because they're going after the same consumer. So you sort of see that here. Like when I was a kid, the major rumors that we heard that were sort of nationwide were all the same thing. So it's like, why? Well, because it works. Mm-hmm. So people go with what works. So, I mean, you can come up with, you know, I'll give you one really good example. There's a conspiracy theorist who's fairly prominent in England named David Icke.
Okay.
And he takes a lot of conspiracy theories and puts them together into one grand conspiracy, but it's about the lizard people.
Right.
So he thinks the queen and the Rothschilds and all the presidents and everything are all lizards, interdimensional lizards. Now he does okay, 'cause he has a cult following for this lizard theory that he has. Mm-hmm. But he got really big a couple years ago where he sort of dropped the lizard aspect of it. And just focused on, he went after the political parties, the governments, and the big banks. Now, who couldn't get angry at those things?
Sure,
right?
And they've shown to participate.
It's not one party or the other. And if you say the big companies, it's not the one that you have your bank account with.
Right.
So when you give an enemy that anyone can agree with is bad, all of a sudden you've got a really viable conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you can. So, I can say some names like HARP, FEMA Camp, New World Order, Freemasons. I mean, I'm almost thinking about. I can't think of his name. Probably the most famous conspiracy theorist, the guy who screams a lot. Alex Jones. I mean, I'm talking Alex Jones right there. Great documentary for my listeners. Check it out. I watch a lot of documentaries. One called The Gray State. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It just came out. Fantastic, fantastically done. But it's a guy who, very libertarian, and it's funny how it seems to grab those libertarian types, those people who don't like to fall in any sort of category, I guess. But he was an Alex Jones disciple and was big on this whole FEMA camps. And I'm not really spun up on that. I don't quite understand. It has something to do with the New World Order is going to put people in camps at some point, and you know they're not emergency management; they're actually there to—I don't know—something like that. But he, so he decided to—he's gonna write a movie about it and film it, and he puts his money into it. And he does a good job as an independent director, and he actually starts getting a movie together. But then he kind of loses grasp of reality, and you start to see in this documentary the guy who put it together. It's a tragedy. You see him kind of go into depression, anxiety, and he ends up murdering his family and killing himself. Yeah, it's a fascinating documentary. But of course, and I got to laud the director for doing this. I mean, he did a good job of not going down that alley too much, but he had to show it. There's a group of people that, of course, think that he, the kid who made this movie, was killed by the government because he was exposing this gray state and the FEMA camps.
Well, the conspiracy theories rebound on themselves. Mm-hmm. So you have the people who say there's a flat Earth, and there's a pushback from the hollow earthers.
Okay.
You know, and then you have people who say the flat earthers are a conspiracy themselves. Mm-hmm. So these things just keep up. During the election, you had people who said, you know, Hillary Clinton's hiding her illness. Uh-huh. You know, so she actually did hide her illness, and she got, I don't know if she got the flu or something like that on 9/11 eerily.
I remember that. Yeah.
Comes out the next day and they say, oh, she's a body double, and we could tell because her pantsuit's a different size, or she's already dead. Or so she goes on the Jimmy Kimmel show to open a jar of pickles to show how strong she is. The next day they say the pickle jar was already opened.
Right.
You know, these things just sort of, you know, keep going back and forth. You know, after the election, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, said, you know, Russia hacked this. We need to raise money for a recount. You know, so she tried to, you know, delegitimize Trump's victory. Now the Democrats have turned on her and say she's a Putin stooge.
Yeah.
So it's just you know, that's right. It's not about the theories or the evidence for the theories. It's just about the mindset that just accept the theories.
Do you ever find yourself in researching these theories, starting to get a little convinced and saying, whoa, whoa, I got to step back a little bit?
I mean, there are some that I talk to my colleagues and I'm like, what is the exact truth on this? Like the CIA cocaine thing. Like, we know right. There's some evidence they did this. We know they were trafficking cocaine.
Yeah.
But sometimes the conspiracy theories go way beyond what the actuality was. Right. So I don't know what the truth was there.
That's a fascinating one. So when I first heard it, I completely discounted it. The CIA. So the idea was that the CIA. So back in the 1980s, there were all these, what do they call those? When you're fighting another country, but you're doing it with the media area, like Afghanistan, Vietnam, they're proxy wars. Yeah. So there was proxy wars going on between the Sandinistas and the Contras down in, was it Honduras? I think it was Honduras. I could have the country.
Guatemala. Nicaragua?
Nicaragua, thank you. So it was going on down there, and we were, politically, it was a hot button topic, and America was not supposed to be involved. So they didn't have any funding. And the idea was, and at least you're right. I know the story, but I couldn't tell you where I got these facts from or these ideas from. I don't, just because of things I've read and I've seen in documentaries and stuff. But documentaries are just somebody putting out a theory. It doesn't. It can be BS. It can be total BS. There's no ethical reason to make a documentary that's true. I mean, so through these documentaries and things I read, is that the CIA was tasked with raising money to buy arms to then give to the or buy or sell the cocaine so the rebels could buy arms to fight the Sandinistas. And so the only way they could do that was to take cocaine, traffic it in, and sell it on the streets of LA. And then people like Freeway Rick Ross, who's he's an interesting character. If you ever want to read up on someone, it would be him. He actually has a documentary out too. But again, a documentary. I mean, it's just basically a documentary of someone grandstanding for you. So I could make a documentary about myself and make me look like a rock star, and I'm just a guy in a Clayton, North Carolina. But of course, then they you know, this guy made it into crack, made millions of dollars off it, and so you can back it all up and say, look, the CIA introduced crack to LA, and you know, this is the result. And then you can plug in any result at that point. You're right. I don't know the 100% truth behind that, but I do know that it's a fact that America was funding the rebels.
I mean, if you're entrepreneurial, I mean, you can be like Alex Jones. Mm-hmm. I mean, you pick the big conspiracy theories that are going to appeal to a segment of the audience that you want to appeal to, and you just give them what they want, right? Mm-hmm. You just have to keep in mind that conspiracy theories rarely overtake, you know, the entire populace.
Right.
So it's tough to, you know, be huge as a conspiracy theorist. Like Alex Jones is sort of a household name now, but for most of his career, he wasn't. He was really only made because Trump mentioned him a bunch of times. But most other conspiracy theorists are sort of, you know, they're backwater people. You know, they're not mainstream stars.
Sometimes it works, and I would point to the Lusitania or maybe the Maine, the sinking of the Maine.
I don't doubt that bad people are conspiring right now to do bad things, and it's important that we catch them and bring them to justice,
right?
Or at least foil their plots, right?
Right.
But that doesn't mean that every conspiracy theory is true. So that's sort of a thing. Because when you say, you know, somebody will come out and say, I think, you know, Sandy Hook or the Vegas shooting or 9/11 is a false flag event. And I say, well, why do you think that? Well, because the government did it 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you know, for, you know, in whatever event.
Right.
And we know what happened then. So therefore, they could do it now. I say, well, they could do it now, but that doesn't mean they did do it now. Mm-hmm. Right. So like 9/11 is a classic one. Like he did 9/11 to take us to war. And it's like he could have taken us to war with Iraq without really doing that.
Yeah, it's very complicated process.
Yeah, why risk this?
Yeah.
You know, when there's no reason to do it. I mean, Clinton had been bombing Iraq throughout the entire 90s, I think.
Sure, yeah.
So people sort of, I think sometimes they get ahead of themselves. But again, it's not so much, you know, a careful thinking through of the evidence, but it's, this is how I think the world works. So when they see something happen, that's how it gets interpreted. Right. I mean, there are other, you know, just like there's a predisposition towards conspiracy thinking, there are ones towards like supernatural, paranormal thinking, mystical thinking, you know. So, you know, people who believe in Da Vinci Code type theories, you know, the idea that, you know, Jesus fathered children with a prostitute and those children were shuffled off to France where they became the kings.
Right.
Yeah. Like if you believe that, I mean, most likely you're into sort of new age, mystic religion type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a type.
Yeah, that you know, that show this. You're definitely not a Catholic.
Right. That's right.
You know, and there are other beliefs too. Like, you know, there are people who are like, I believe in Bigfoot, and they also believe in the Loch Ness Monster and Sasquatch and aliens and this stuff. So there are people who are just prone to that sort of, you know, I believe in, you know, the paranormal stuff. Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of people on the show on that side of it, and there isn't enough convincing in the world. I mean, I've even gone on ghost hunts with psychics and paranormal investigators, and I haven't seen anything yet. But I have seen things where I guess I could interpret it if I wanted to. I think a lot of these people are lacking the understanding of chaos theory. You know, the magic bullet, the magic bullet on Kennedy, you know, how did that happen? It's impossible for that magic bullet to go through four people and change trajectory. And then, I mean, two people change trajectory and then land on the gurney unscathed. Well, it really isn't. It's not impossible. Anything's possible within chaos theory. Doors closing by themselves is possible. It just, I guess when things are unexplained and you have trouble on explaining them, it's more fun, I guess, to put them on something higher than yourself or something that's mystical or magical or paranormal or something.
I mean, Noam Chomsky said it pretty well. And I would almost sort of expected him to come out in favor of 9/11 conspiracy theories. But he said, you know, one, there was no reason for the Republicans to do this because if they were caught, they'd all be hung. Mm-hmm. And second of all, he said, in any scientific experiment, you're always going to have weird things that are not explained.
Right.
It doesn't matter how controlled it is. You're always going to have little weird things that happen and they get written up at the back of a scientific journal article. But people look at those oddities as if they're the rule or as if, you know, there's some big thing to them and there really isn't. I mean, the funny thing, you know, you bring up the bullet. It's just like, you know, no one can exactly replicate the path of this bullet. But here's the thing. You couldn't replicate the path of any bullet.
Right.
Right? Like if you're up there and you know, up in the bookstore, and there's a car driving by, and you hit the car, it's always going to be a little bit different every time.
Sure.
Not majorly different, but just enough so that you're never going to hit it exactly. So to me, that's just not evidence to say, you know, when they come out and say, oh, well, we had expert marksmen who couldn't replicate this perfectly. Well, of course they can't. You can't replicate anything that's messy in life perfectly.
Right. But it's still anything's possible. I always tell people, if you don't believe anything's possible, take a clump of matter, make it explode, send it shooting out into infinite space, and then have it eventually come back together and make an iPhone. If you believe that's possible, then I guess anything's possible, right?
I mean, anything can happen. And I think, you know, what people really need to think about isn't as much what's, you know, what's possible, but sort of what's likely.
Mm-hmm.
So is it likely, and you have to ask the right questions too, is it likely that there was a grand conspiracy to kill President Kennedy and cover it up and it was successful for 53 years? What's the likelihood that that's true?
Right.
I mean, at this point, I'm approaching zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's funny is most people disagree with me. I mean, 60% of the country says, yeah, there was a conspiracy.
Right. I think too, and this is probably a cliche with conspiracy theories because I know I've heard it, is that it makes a seemingly random act into something more important. So you take the leader of the free world and you kill him. And it's a random act by a psychopath who had some sort of political motive. All right. So someone that simple can take down the most powerful man in the world? No, I don't want to believe that. I want to believe that in order to take down the most powerful man in the world, in order to take down the most powerful symbol of capitalism, the Twin Towers, you need a conspiracy. And well, first it was a conspiracy. There was like, what, I don't remember now, 20 hijackers, something like that. But it had to be the U.S. government. There had to be a bigger reason for it. It couldn't have just been for Allah and to punish Americans.
I mean, that's a major debate going on between myself and other people who study this.
Mm-hmm.
Is because it's always this trope that, you know, people try to find grand explanations for big events, right? It can't be some small explanation for the murder of a president or, you know, right, blowing up the Twin Towers. It's got to be something bigger. And it's not necessary. I don't think it's the case that that's really driving it.
Okay.
Big events attract conspiracy theories just because, not because they're big per se, but because they get a lot of media attention.
Mm-hmm.
And because they get media attention, people are talking about it. And they're seeing this. They have this information coming in. And for the people who have this predisposition, they're just going to interpret it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So big events will attract more conspiracy theories, but it's not that there's a disposition to explain a big event. It's just that the people are being exposed to that event more than okay. some other. That's what I think is true anyway, because mm-hmm. there are big events and then there are not so big events, and it's somewhat random why some will attract conspiracy theories or some will not. I mean, it's not like we have lingering conspiracy theories about Garfield or McKinley.
Right, right.
But Kennedy, yes. I mean, to me, and I'll tell you, this is my personal belief about the Kennedy thing. It's just, to me, it was just that the left could not accept that one of their own killed the person on their side. They just could not accept it. So yeah. They had to come up with something else. So it had to be, you know, instead of being a communist, it had to be one of many organizations that they despise.
CIA.
You know, or that they are. Yeah, the CIA, the military, Bell Helicopter, you know, you name it. Mm-hmm. All sorts of different things that they didn't like. So it wasn't someone on our side, somebody who we didn't like. It was a villain who did it. So, and it's never ceases to amaze me that the people we don't like are always the ones who are the cause of everything bad that we see in the world.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's never anyone on our own side that does anything wrong.
That's right.
It's never my party's fault. It's never my fault. It's always somebody else's fault.
the thing that's amazing about Kennedy's assassination compared to Garfield or McKinley is it happened 15 years before I was born, rough give or take, and I saw it. You know, I was able to see it, and I can close my eyes and see him get his head blown off, which is amazing. You know, my children will be able to see this. So it was something that I think it definitely hit the American psyche. I mean, were there bigger assassinations? I mean, there were more meaningful, I hate to say that, but I guess like Franz Ferdinand was more meaningful, meaning it had more repercussions across the geopolitical sphere. But I couldn't tell you what he looked like. I don't think there was a, there might have been a photograph of, I can't think of the guy's name who did it now, the Black Hand. Well, whatever. But the assassin, I couldn't tell you what he looked like. I mean, there's a perfect example. I can't tell you all the details. But with Kennedy, I mean, it was really the first social, almost execution of a person that just burned in the psyche of generations to come. And not to mention, he was the leader of the free world. So I guess I understand. I mean, that's my thinking. And obviously, I don't study this. I study physiology and things like that. But my understanding would be that it's such a powerful thing that we need an explanation for it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, to put it in a different context, I mean, planes go down not often, but once in a while. Mm-hmm. Some attract a lot of conspiracy theories and some don't.
Right, right.
Right? Right. Like the Malaysian jet, the mm-hmm. first one did. The second one didn't.
Or the one off New York there, they, I remember that for the longest time. They thought they saw a missile going up to it or something.
Yeah. There was a TWA flight going back decades that attracted a lot of conspiracy theories, and then there are other ones that don't.
But then there's ones so, like Lockerbie where it was a conspiracy. I mean,
yeah.
I can't remember who it was, but a terrorist organization conspired to bring down, I think it was Gaddafi, wasn't it? It was blamed on Gaddafi anyways. So yeah, I mean, so we have confirmation bias in ourselves where we say, well, look, it's happened in the past. Why can't this random event be as important as that one? Why can't the people that, you know, fell out of the sky over here seemingly meaningless, why can't we put meaning to that and say, you know, there was something bigger associated with it?
It's funny, you get into this stuff and a lot of times the conspiracy thinking overlaps with some of those other styles of thinking
right. That
I talked about, like paranormal and supernatural.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
Because I think about the X-Files, you have this, you know, government conspiracy, but there's also aliens and there's ESP and...
Oh yeah, they touch it all.
Every religion winds up being true in the X-Files and ghosts are real and this is real and that's real. So, you know, conspiracy theory is sort of part of a bucket of alternative ideas that is often mixed in with other stuff that outlets sort of mix together to draw in big audiences. I mean, X-Files is one thing. There are radio programs like Coast to Coast that run overnight that have, you know, like, you know, 300 affiliates where they... You know, 1 minute it's the alien conspiracy, and then the next segment is, you know, magic crystals. You know, so you wind up mixing these people together, and a lot of times, you know, you have these people that believe in conspiracy theories. They believe that aliens are coming here. They believe in ESP. So you got people with a lot of wrong beliefs and a predisposition to buy into wrong stuff. I mean, if you look around, there's a lot of, you know, to me, having done this for almost a decade, like I never thought about these things before I got into it, but it's like now I call BS on so much stuff.
Yeah.
Like I was watching the Megyn Kelly morning show maybe a couple weeks ago, and her two segments, you know, one of them was Dr. Oz, who's always promoting fake medicine.
Oh yeah. I'm not a big fan of him.
And then right after that, it was like a near death experience where the woman said, I was surgery and technically dead, and then I floated above my body. I saw these things, and then when I repeated it to the surgeon when I came to, he said he just doesn't know how I could have known these things. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, well, this is evidence of some sort of spirit thing or floating soul or whatever. I said, no, it's not evidence of anything. It's something happened. We don't know how. It doesn't lead you anywhere, yes. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But we see this sort of stuff all the time. Like somebody jumped to a conspiracy theory or a paranormal explanation, and they're not always very good explanations. They're easy explanations, but they're not necessarily good.
I guess it makes lives more interesting when it adds color to an otherwise black and white event.
Like I would love to, I watch Finding Bigfoot.
Okay.
You know, where the team goes out in the woods and they hunt Bigfoots, yeah. And they get together with the townsfolk and they have a big meal and they say, who's seen the Bigfoot? And everyone raises their hand.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would love to do that. That would be a lot of fun to go run around the woods at night with a camera and, oh, I heard something, you know, go catch it.
Sure.
I mean, that would be fun. And it would be fun to sort of suspend reality and think that, mm-hmm. you know, there's a Bigfoot running around and I'm going to catch it.
Right.
Fun. But, you know, putting that aside, there's no Bigfoot running around in the woods.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I have taken a lot of your time. Do you have a Twitter or anything like that? Do you have social media people can follow you on?
Yeah. I'm at Joe Uszinski on Twitter.
All right. Uszinski, just for.
Yeah. So at Joeuszinski.
Okay.
And joeuszinski.com, and please follow me.
Okay, and your books are The People's News, Media Politics, and the Demands of Capitalism, and the other one is right here in front of me, but Journal of Politics, Political Research. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's where you published. There it is, American Conspiracy Theories. So you can check those out. I'm assuming they're on Amazon and all those cool places. All right. And I'll link to your profile here at the University of Miami on my site. I thank you very much for taking your time. It's folks like you that take your time to talk to me that allow these little independent shows to get out there and reach my four or five listeners and have a little bit of success. So I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to do it. All right. It was fun.
Enjoyed the warm weather down there. I would like to say it would be warm here. It is. It's going to be 60 on Saturday. But until then, we have about 4 or 5 inches of snow out there, and it's still coming down. So I have a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they are loving it.
Well, I'm going to Disney this weekend.
So. All right. Well,
that's the weather in Florida.
Enjoy yourself. All right. Well, thank you again.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
All right, you're welcome. Bye-bye. That was Joe Uszinski. You are listening to Wait What If Podcast with Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for listening. Make sure you visit us at www.waitwhatif.com. Check out my other things on waitwhatif.com/... I'm just bullshitting you. Great show. Interesting guy. Check him out at Joe Uszinski, Uszinski. That should be about it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.